This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
How does infertility impact every aspect of your life, from your mental health to the friends you potentially lose to the jobs you don't take? As many of you may have heard this morning, Charnel, our breakfast presenter, spoke so openly and beautifully about her experience. This is just a tiny bit.
We are beyond overjoyed. We are also terrified. We're still trying to contain our excitement because when you've been on the road of infertility, you always prepare for bad news. You put your life on hold. You don't take holidays because what if you need another round? You don't take new jobs because what if you do fall pregnant? You commit to nothing except this journey. You put your life on hold.
Have you put your life on hold as well? Or maybe as a partner, a friend, or as a boss? Do you know how to properly support someone who is living through the medical and the emotional world of trying to fall pregnant? How does infertility impact every aspect of your day-to-day life? And also coming up in about 15, 20 minutes' time, did you know that there is a very common flower, maybe in a vase, on your kitchen bench as we speak, that could kill your cat?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So how does the infertility journey that you or your partner or your friend or your sister is on, how does it impact every aspect of your life, from your mental health to the friends that you make or the friends that you lose to the jobs that you do or don't take? Professor Jayashree Kulkarni, AM, is the director of the Monash University's HER Centre Australia. Jayashree, Charnel's story this morning, part of the reason why she wanted to share it is that she knows that she's not alone, that so many women face every aspect of their life being impacted by infertility. And quite often they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to share it, which is what made today so important. It does impact everything from your mental health to your friendship groups.
Absolutely, it does. And congratulations to Charnel for several things. First of all, we all wish her all the best with the pregnancy, but congratulations to her for being so brave and honest and opening up discussion on a very important topic. So many women experience issues with infertility, and it has huge ramifications. One of my patients once said to me, who had been, you know, in the IVF treatment program, unsuccessful for many cycles and all the rest of it, said that she was told there was, in inverted commas, nothing to cry about. And by that, she meant that there was no conceptus, there was no fetus, there was no baby, and so it was nothing to cry about. So, you know, that really hit me as a treating psychiatrist, and I've seen many, many patients who have had resultant awful depression, anxiety, but also this total loss of self-esteem, loss of self-confidence, and almost sometimes ostracism from their world. And that can be because of self, feeling like a failure and not being able to be one with the peer group. Or it can actually be ostracism from others. You know, there can be parents who want to be grandparents and so on and so on. So it has huge ramifications. And unfortunately, it's one of the further stresses that we know women are under, you know, to perform, to be performing in this biological fertility sense is another thing. But we also need to remember that the hormones that are used for fertility also, in some women, can have dreadful mental health consequences in that they are potent in brain effects as well. So that's another factor to consider.
When we look at how long this can take for some people, and obviously Charnel said today she feels like one of the lucky ones that does result in a pregnancy. That's not the case for every woman and for every couple. But quite often it's years and years and years. And what did stand out to me is the bit that I played of all of a sudden you think, well, I can't take a holiday, I can't take that job, or I'll stay in this job. All of the life decisions that you do or don't make as a result of trying to become pregnant, is that something that a lot of people don't think about?
Absolutely. It is a journey, and you are out of control of your own destiny to some extent, because what happens is the determinant of your next, weeks and months is very much the hormone cycles and the treatment cycles and what's going to then occur. So there is a lot of that complete holding the breath and everything is on hold. And even, women saying things like they don't exercise in the same way, or they're worrying about what they eat, and, all sorts of things that you would just take for granted suddenly go by the wayside. So it's a really, really stressful, difficult time. And again, I applaud Charlene for actually raising this, because it's not talked about, because I think women feel like they're a failure. And it often is both people in the couple can feel like that. But, the woman has two-thirds of the responsibility in the sense of conceiving and then carrying. And so often she will walk around feeling like a big failure and doesn't want to broadcast that and talk about that. But it is important to understand that this is not a failure. This is nothing in terms of, some people have blue eyes, some people have brown eyes, absolutely. Some people can have babies, some people can't. So, it should be seen in that kind of variation of our human existence, but that doesn't help if somebody's very keen to be a mum, and then we do everything we can.
And it being year after year. You're listening to Professor Jayashree Kulkarni, AM Director of Monash University's Her Centre Australia. This infertility conversation really hits home. I'm stuck in a stressful job, but I'm scared to leave because we're trying for a baby and I don't want to start somewhere new, only maybe to fall pregnant. Suzanne's called from Sassafras. Good morning, Suzanne. What did you want to share?
Great that we're having this conversation, because I know when I experienced infertility in the mid-19 or early 90s, last century, folks, there was nothing that was actually really considered about it. And I did access counselling. And when I went to the counsellor, who oddly enough was pregnant, and it was provided by the IVF services, she said not many people actually took it up. I was doing my studies at that time, and I actually did a paper on a thesis on the experience of infertility and its multiple forms of grief, which did help me, I think. Mm. But I was able to go on and have two children, miraculously just independent of all medical services. But I had gone through, I think it was five rounds of IVF. But I also, I took a year off because I thought it must be me. I must be too busy and stressed or whatever. And it stays with you, actually, even after you, if you are lucky enough to have a child. Because I remember my son being about 6 months old and all of a sudden having this epiphany that, hey, actually, it was all mine and, things were actually... if you like, a normal experience. We had been hypersensitive to all the interventions, if you like, and I could finally relax a bit.
Oh, Suzanne, I know. Isn't it amazing when you have that moment of, I can finally relax? But, Suzanne, what I loved about many aspects of the story that you shared, and Chanel used this word today as well, which was grief, Jayashree. When we think about the mental health services, connection, understanding, acceptance that we have with grief. We get that, right, as a society. However, when it comes to infertility, the years and years of trying to fall pregnant, and at the end you may or may not become pregnant, do we offer the same kind of counselling, understanding, empathy, research to mental health with this like, is this still in an emerging area?
No.
Yeah.
Look, I've said this before, women's mental health is not high on anyone's agenda in terms of resourcing and research and so on. I mean, it's getting more traction, but, you know, there's so much to do. And this is another area that really does require understanding and research so that it can be translated into appropriate help for women. And it comes back to this statement. The grief is, you know, if somebody has had a death of someone, then there is a sort of standard grieving process and people can be helped down that. This is what my patient said, that there was nothing to cry about because there hadn't been a person yet. So it becomes this difficult scenario that, again, in a private therapeutic sense, yes, you'll have excellent therapists who will work on the whole issue of what this person wanted isn't going to happen or what didn't happen, and so now that particular event of becoming a parent is not going to happen, so you grieve that. But it's different, very different, to actually losing somebody who's been alive and out there. So it's again, we need to understand a whole lot of different ways to help people. And again, we need people to talk about this so that
that's
not
why it's
shameful.
Important. Yeah, of course, and to normalise it. I mean, there's text here that says, oh my goodness, I'm at work in tears. My daughter is going through IVF. The first round has failed. We are just devastated. It's all consuming for her. And I just don't know what to do or say. What a beautiful message from a mum, because that's the other thing too, right? We're getting better at least saying, okay, what do I do or say here? Because any comment could not sound right, could be triggering, could do more harm than good. You know, the best of intentions, even other texts coming in, people saying things like, oh, when are you going to start a family? Oh, you only have one child. Are you going to try for another? Little throwaway comments that could just, you know, cut through your heart in such a devastating and painful way. For a mum, for a parent, for a partner, for a friend, for a sibling who is watching someone they love go through this, is there right or wrong in terms of what to say and how to be supportive?
I think it's interesting that, you know, we need to, as a society, perhaps recognise that having a child is not the community's business. You know, for a long time, the pregnant woman was sort of community property. And, you know, there were stories of people would go up to the stranger pregnant woman and pat her belly and
sort
of stuff, you know.
Oh, that happened to me. It's so bizarre.
But it's not right, because we need to get away from this concept that having a baby is a community event.
Other people's business, yeah.
It is not anyone's business other than the person, you know, who's going to become pregnant and the person she wants to help her become pregnant, you know. And I'm very keen that we get away from that question, that we mustn't be asking people, oh, are you going to have a family? Or why have you only got one kid? Or, you know, it's none of your business. And it doesn't matter whether you're the grandparent to be or whatever, you know, it's not your business. Yeah. Unless that person comes to you and wants to talk about whatever, then you can have a discussion. So that would be number one thing. Number two thing I think we need to also understand is the choice, that it isn't that every woman has to have a baby and that's the norm. Let's get away from that as well.
That's a bigger conversation you and I need to have, Jo-Sri.
It is, but, you know,
that's right, that your life isn't somehow complete unless you have had a child.
Unless you have children.
There's a text here from...
We need to get away.
Yeah, there's a text here from Anne who says, oh, this is such a fabulous session. Thank you. Grief is the word. My daughter is undergoing IVF due to genetic issues, watching her grieve and grieving too. It's heartbreaking and it is breaking my heart. And others that say the grief and loss associated with infertility is disenfranchised grief. It's a type of grief that society doesn't often see and doesn't often recognise. The work that you do, Jo-Sri, is looking at this and recognising not only the grief, but recognising different points of women's life where their mental health will be different, and that it will be different based on gender as well. And that is a huge step forward. But today has been a really, I think, important conversation for all of us, and not just the person and not just the woman who is trying to become pregnant, but for everyone in that inner circle, work colleagues, bosses included, you know, the person that you do or don't hire due to a woman's age.
Yes. Absolutely. That's a whole other topic as well.
Isn't it, right?
So, yes.
Yeah, if you're 35, I mean, as Chanel said, the thank you for hiring a 35-year-old woman.
Which is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's really good to voice what should be primitive thinking and gone, but it's not. It's with us. So, again, we need to separate out biology and reproduction from the person, because we have the person, you know, the woman here, and she has so many attributes and so many things that she's doing and offering and providing. Yes, she might have desires to become pregnant, and that's fine. That's her business, and we wish her all the best, and we use every technology we can, which also has advanced. But if she does not become pregnant, then that does not mean she has failed as a person. That's really important to get across to her, as well as, you know, to everyone. And that babies are private business, not the community's.
Yeah, don't go rubbing a woman's belly if you don't know her. And even if you do know her, maybe ask permission if you can touch her stomach. Jayashree, it's always wonderful to speak to you about the work that you're doing. I think we've got a couple of other topics we need to get you back in and chat about. But thanks so much for your time.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much, Michelle.
Professor Jayashree Kulkarni, AM. She's the director of the Monash University's HER Centre Australia. You can jump online and look at the incredible work and research that they're doing as well. So it's HER, of course, H-E-R Centre Australia. Coming up in just a moment, would you like to see ultra fast food have the same kind of labels and warning as tobacco? Well, there are researchers all around the world that think that it's time.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
And before we speak about whether or not ultra-fast food should have labels like smoking, I want to talk about another potential label that may be needed. So there is a petition that's been doing the rounds online, and it was actually started from heartache from a pet lover. So a young man has taken to change.org to ask for a warning to be put onto flowers, some really common flowers that are toxic to some animals, in particular cats. So he noticed that Reuben, his cat, was drinking more water and was losing weight, took Reuben to the vet, to only be told that his one-year-old cat had kidney disease. And then he realised what had happened, that the flowers that he had received, because his mum had just recently died, had lilies in them. Now, lilies, if you didn't know, are highly toxic to cats. So he's now asking for labelling to go on to some particular flowers and even posters to be put up near checkouts, just to inform people of some of these toxic flowers and pets. Dr. Melissa Meehan is the Director of Veterinary Services at the RSPCA Victoria. Melissa, what do you think of this idea that is being started to just put small labels onto flowers that are particularly or dangerous to cats and dogs?
Yeah, hi, Rochelle. I think it's a marvellous idea. If we can stop people from buying them, or at least if they are making the decision to gift them, be aware of the potential huge risks to cat owners in particular, then, you know, we're going to avoid a whole lot of emergency visits and potential fatalities. So it's a great idea.
So do most people know, because one of the flowers, like lilies, for example, they're very common, and they're not just at florists, they're at supermarkets, service stations, flowers markets, farmers markets, they're very, very common.
Yeah, they are. And I mean, it's, you kind of don't even think of it because they're so common. I know I even was gifted them when, you know, I was having my babies, and I had a cat, and I put them high on the mantelpiece, and I didn't even connect the two, and I'm a vet. So I think I don't blame people for not thinking about the potential risks. And I think if there's a label and we can avoid risks to a common household pet that is very loved, then why not?
What are some of the symptoms that you're... And does it just impact cats? So Lily's, for example, does it hurt dogs as well?
It can, but they're much less toxic to dogs. So with cats, I mean, they can be exposed to any part of the lily and even the water that the lily was sitting in the vase. So they're very, very toxic to them. And essentially what the lily does is it causes kidney failure acutely. So within 24 to 72 hours, that cat could potentially die from the toxicity. The symptoms that people may notice at the start would be vomiting, maybe being a bit off their food, increased thirst and increased urination. And they're all signs that the kidneys have already been affected. So these cats are already showing acute signs of kidney failure. Drooling might be a symptom which is shown after ingestion. But if they've simply rubbed against the lily haven't actually eaten it, because that's what I thought. I thought, well, Finn's not going to eat the flower. But if they jumped up on the mantelpiece, for example, and just walked past it, as they do, and some of the pollen went on their tail or their fur, and then they went and cleaned themselves afterwards, that's a toxicity waiting to happen.
And the little yellow bits of pollen, it drops, right? You see it fall onto your bench or onto your table, and because because it stains things as well. So you're like, oh, don't put it near that. So it drops and it moves. So it's something you need to. Lots of texts, Melissa, coming in on, you know, other flowers, even things like scented candles and air fresheners need to have pet poison warnings. Just generally, does there need to be better pet poison warnings? We hear a lot about Christmas and dogs and chocolate and Easter and all that sort of stuff. But just across the board, does there need to be better communication here?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I don't know whether I'm biased, as are all the other pet lovers out there. But it's a huge cost to owners. And there are a lot of people out there that can't afford the treatment to deal with the after effects of these potential toxins. So I think it's a responsibility of prescribing doctors, pharmacists and florists in this instance, and even chocolate vendors to potentially start putting warnings on labels. But I think Lily's, as this gentleman is campaigning for, is a fantastic start because they are so toxic.
And I think if nothing else at the moment, educate yourself if you have a cat, even just doing some research, whether it be through the RSPCA or just a simple Google search to look at what flowers are and aren't safe if you have pets in the house. I mean, there's text here saying lilies are my favourite flowers, but I haven't had one in 7 years since I got my fluff balls. Now it's only gerberas and Lego flowers. So just doing that research. And maybe if you're a florist or you sell flowers, maybe you can do a little bit of research and, you know, who doesn't love a label maker, right? You can get out a label maker and make your own.
Exactly. And who doesn't love a florist that cares about animals? So, I mean, the two go hand in hand, don't they?
Yeah, well, look, maybe this change.org petition might change all of that and we'll start to see those labels. If you have seen them out and about, let us know. And if you're a florist and you do this, let us know as well. Melissa, thank you. It's really important. Dr. Melissa Meehan, who's the Director of Veterinary Services at RSPCA Victoria. And just a tick, we're going to continue the label conversation around whether or not ultra-fast food should also have labels, maybe similar to smoking, and should those huge fast food companies be treated like tobacco companies? The Arias are on tonight, and it's no surprises that the band of the moment, Amyl and the Sniffers, are nominated for six, yes, you heard it, six different nominations at the Arias. So people are probably off at the hairdressers getting their nails done, a spray tan or two. Helen Foster may be one of them. And Helen is Gus's mum. And Gus is from Amyl and the Sniffers. She is the mum of Gus Roma. Gus is the bass player for Amyl and the Sniffers. Helen, are you getting a spray tan all ready for this evening?
No, spray tan's not really my style. I'm doing the modulated version of getting ready for
I don't blame you.
Right now.
First things first, congratulations. I mean, what a wild ride that Gus has been on over the last couple of years. Of course, there's supporting AC/DC, there's the Grammys, now there's the Arias, there's the incredible work that the band did of giving $5,000 to a heap of local music venues here in Melbourne when their free gig was cancelled. Was Gus always destined to be a rock and roll star?
We thought he was. From a very young age, Gus was always very active, very on the go, and really into all of the arts. So he was a visual artist as well as a musician. So, yeah, we always felt Gus had something a little bit special in him. Yeah.
And he left Hobart. So you're in Hobart. This is where Gus grew up. And he left to Melbourne to join Amyl and the Sniffers?
He did. He auditioned. Amyl came down to Hobart and did a gig, and his band that he was playing in Hobart supported Amyl. And they phoned him soon after and asked him if he'd like to audition, and he flew up and auditioned, and he moved to Melbourne soon after.
Wow. Did you ever expect it to end like this, Helen? I mean, first things first, a lot of parents are like, really? You want to go into rock and roll? Maybe. Don't you want to become a lawyer, a doctor, a GP, a teacher, to go into the world of rock and roll, but then to end up and to be this successful?
I was definitely like that. And each time Gus has come home and told us something really exciting was happening, each time I thought, oh, really? Gosh. We've been on the journey with Gus as he's each of the exciting things that he's undertaken as part of this. But no, not in our wildest dreams did we think we'd be here right now.
When we look at people who, you know, we just come from humble, normal beginnings, could be any of us, and then make it into fame. When they come home, slipping back into reality, right? So Bob Murphy was talking this morning about the draft picks and when footballers become semi-famous and when they come home, you know, Bob was saying, word of advice, don't talk about footy. Just let them be normal. Let them be siblings. Let them be sons. Let them be daughters. When Gus is back home, does he want to talk about his rock and roll life, or does he just want to hang out with mum?
No, he definitely just wants to hang out with mum. And the first thing we often do is get in the car and drive to somewhere where he can smell the sea salt air and kind of have the wind blow in his hair. So we drive, we go out somewhere, and he just soaks in that fresh Tassie salty air and relaxes. And he's pretty anonymous in Hobart, other than his small group of friends that he catches up with that have been his friends since high school. He's pretty anonymous there, so that's good.
Were you expected to get the invite tonight? I mean, this is the thing, right? It's the mums, it's the parents that are often there that are driving them to gigs and doing all of the hard yards. Do you deserve this invitation to the Arias tonight, Helen? Did you expect it?
I didn't expect it, and I'm very excited. I think there's a whole community behind me back in Hobart barracking for me right now. All my work colleagues, I think everybody was really excited, and they're all coming on this journey with me for this evening. Yeah.
Well, they seem like the most humble rock and roll band you could ever imagine. Helen, I hope you have a great night tonight and rub shoulders with some really famous people and get to have great chats in the loos and, you know, speak to some big rock and roll stars tonight.
Thank you so much.
Good on you, Helen. Helen Foster, who's the mum of Gus Roemer, who is the bass player for Amyl and the Sniffers. Gus has invited his mum to the Arias tonight. They're heading off and they've been nominated 6 times tonight. I reckon they'll bring home a nomination or two. Up next, should ultra-fast food be labelled in the same way as tobacco?
ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Well, we're loving a label today, so I'm going to throw another one at you. So ultra fast food, would you like to see labels on that fast food around its health implications in the same way we do on tobacco companies, so putting health over profit. Well, about 43 international experts are urging governments all around the world to better regulate this multi-trillion dollar industry, the ultra-processed food industry. Dr. Priscilla Machado, National Health and Medical Research Council Emerging Leadership Fellow, who's at the Institute for Physical Activity and Nutrition at Deakin. Priscilla, you and I have spoken on and off for years about the impacts of ultra-fast food. But what keeps happening is the lines become very blurred around the information that we're given, the health washing that we receive on what is ultra-processed food. So before we get into the labels, do you think the average person actually knows what ultra-processed food even is anymore, other than, say, hot chips?
That's a great point, and thanks, Rochelle, for having me again today. And it's the third time. I hope I bring some more uplifting news the next time. But it's really an important topic. And this morning, this important Lancet series on ultra-processed foods was published. This is one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, really bringing those experts together to think about the impacts of ultra-processed foods and implications for reducing the consumption. And ultra-processed foods, for those who probably I'm hearing this for the first time, are foods that are packaged and they are made of industrial ingredients that you don't often find in your home pantry. So that includes things like fast food meals, chips, soft drinks and confectionery, those foods that people often connect as or call junk foods. But ultra-processed foods also include things that people may not realize are ultra-processed, and that includes things like protein bars, meat alternatives, flavored milk drinks and yogurts. So really it's difficult for people to recognize an ultra-processed foods because the way these foods are presented in the supply is very confusing, first thing.
And the things that I sort of wrote down then and strongly underlined was meat alternatives. Very often they are packaged in a way that screams health food.
Exactly.
That this is a really good alternative for you to eat. Yogurts we assume and associate with health. Our ready-made meals, these are items that are not only pitched to us as healthy, but easy and good for your family. So it's this area of ultra-processed food that I find the most disturbing, because we can all make a choice to eat hot chips, you know, crisps, soft drink, and we all sort of know if that's bad for us, it's a sometimes food, that's fine. It's this other emerging area where maybe we think we're doing the right thing.
Yes, that's a great point. And that's being exploited by the food industry into marketing. And when you look at the front of the package of ultra-processed foods, such as meat alternatives and those flavored milk drinks, you often find a lot of health claims, which are those informations such as high in protein, high in fiber and vitamins and minerals. But that's actually what we call a health halo to, you know, show that the product's healthier than it actually is. So that is misleading consumers.
How do they get away with that?
Well, we need stronger regulations on health claims, and that's one of the propositions for that ultra-processed foods. They shouldn't carry any of those health claims. And now with people getting more worried about climate change and sustainability, there is a lot of new uptake on environmental claims, the green washing. So saying things like these foods have low carbon footprint or they are more sustainable, and that's also not quite regulated yet.
Dr. Priscilla Machado is with you, Research Fellow in the Institute for Physical Activity and Nutrition at Deakin University. Priscilla, this, as you said, has been published today in The Lancet. This is a globally recognised publication. 43 international experts have come together to say ultra-processed food companies need to be regulated like tobacco. That's a huge statement. Is that ever likely to happen?
We need to believe and fight for it, for sure. And because tobacco is quite interesting, the history of the regulation of tobacco and the strategies to delay policy are quite similar to the ones applied by ultra-processed food industry. In fact, Philip Morris, which owned tobacco, actually bought a lot of ultra-processed food companies and applied the same strategies. So, for instance, creating products that are highly palatable and quasi addictive as well. And in terms of the marketing, and they act into pushing governments to delay any action by lobbying governments, by pushing for self-regulation or doing litigation, which is delaying any, you know, policy responses. And that's happening in the food, ultra-processed food industry as well. And the impacts of ultra-processed foods to our health are enormous. We are talking about things like type 2 diabetes, heart disease, mental illness, like depression, things that are very common in our communities. And we really need to take action because of the major impacts they have.
When you say there's strategies applied to almost trick us into eating some of this food. And as we said, there is the section of junk food that we know and we understand and we can make that choice to not eat it. However, the emerging world of everything from ready-made meals and meat alternatives, yogurts, you name it, where there are health halos wrapped around it. Have we started to see as a society yet? You've mentioned diabetes, you've mentioned, you know, heart disease, all of those things. Has the link been made enough that governments anywhere around the world can start to push these regulations onto these companies?
Yes, the evidence is very strong for action now. And one of the papers from the series really puts together that large body of evidence showing the impacts of ultra-processed foods in over like series of chronic disease, including those that I mentioned as well. So there is really enough evidence to act and to justify action. The issue is now the debate on how to do it. And I think we can talk about what governments can do, but just before that, I want to bring that discussion about how people get informed about ultra-processed foods. And I think the challenge is to differentiate what is information and what is marketing. And that's very confusing at the moment from the package, but also in social media, in television, it's really complicated. People really are getting confused because of these different messages. And nutrition is quite conflicting.
Yeah, absolutely. My feed is full of it. If some random tells me how much protein I should be eating anymore, I think I need to sort of delete a couple of apps off my phone just quietly. Messages like this, don't confuse hot chips from your local fish and chip shop with those from fast food retailers. Potatoes are cooked in oil at fish and chip shops. They're not ultra processed. Can you please ask your expert to define what exactly makes good ultra processed? Is there such a thing? As good. I mean, hot chips are my weakness, right? They are my kryptonite. But there is a big difference, I think, as this text said, of potatoes cooked in oil versus some of the other hot chips that you throw in the oven out of a packet. You can just tell from the texture. And I remember talking to you years ago about the addiction to texture and the amount of people that work in labs to ensure that we don't even have to chew much, that we can just shove heaps of these things into our mouth and swallow and eat really quickly. So there's hot chips and there's hot chips.
Yes, that's such a great question. And the evidence from the studies not support any difference in one or two processed foods in another. We are not quite there yet. What we know is that the level of consumption of ultra-processed foods is what matters, which means the amount you have of these foods in your overall diet. So really, the evidence is not about avoiding them completely. In fact, you know, there is countries and even populations that don't have like those levels of heart disease and other health outcomes and have around 10 or 15% of their diets from ultra-processed foods. So the message is really trying to reduce the higher intakes that the population have.
And giving us the education and the truth around what we're eating. There's so many questions and I won't be able to get through all of them, but I'm going to try and whip through a couple. So Meg says, I'm so interested to hear your guest's thoughts today. You're listening to Dr. Priscilla Machado, Research Fellow at the Institute for Physical Activity and Nutrition at Deakin. We're talking about new research that's been published today in The Lancet on labelling around ultra-processed food. Meg wants to know about baby foods, so the pouches, the bars, the puffed vegetables, that whole world of preying on parents who are tired and sleep deprived and fussy eaters. Whew, dare I open this can of worms? Does this fall into it as well?
many of these products are ultra-processed. Not all of them, but of course a lot of them are. And it's not regulated. And another, a lot of advocacy groups in Australia are trying to push governments to regulate the quality of the ingredients of these foods, but also the marketing and the placement of these foods in the supermarket. They have a lot of health claims, way more than the claims that you would find in a product that's targeted to adults, for example, have way more claims in children's products. And that's unfair because people really are trying to look after themselves and look after their families. And as you said, you know, people go shopping with time pressures, they are resource poor, and it's a lot of barriers to overcome.
And we're stressed and we're working longer than ever and we believe what we read. And, you know, I can remember standing in the baby food aisle desperate for my daughter to eat one time. I think she was teething and something, maybe she had her tonsils out, I can't even remember. And it was just a terrible time. And looking at all these baby pouches and so many of them were vegetables. I'm like, but hang on, the use by date says it was a couple of years away. I'm like, how can a vegetable be years away from expiring and be on a shelf? And one of them had meat in it, apparently. I was like, but how? It's on a shelf. It's not even refrigerated.
Yes, definitely one of the best ways is to offer young children good foods you would eat yourself, you know, in different texture, use like a puree, etc. But really being cautious about the those types of children-targeted products.
What would you like done with this research? How serious is, I guess this is my final question, how serious is our federal or even our state government in creating these labels to give us the information in the same way we would tobacco companies? And as we've learnt today, one of the tobacco companies is already behind and marketing these ultra-fast food companies. So they know who they are.
Yes, so Australia is falling behind international best practice for policies to regulate ultra-processed foods. For instance, warning labels, these black and white stop signs in the front of the packages of products, have been implemented in several countries in Latin America.
And what would the warnings say?
They say often
delicious but dangerous.
Yeah, it's often based on the levels of salt, sugar, and fat. There is no proposition of ultra-processed food science per se yet, which we are exploring in research at Deakin University right now. But the positive, I think there's a lot of opportunities if Australia moves towards that warning label and takes the experience of other countries like Chile, because those products that carry the warning label, they cannot be sold in schools. They cannot have a cartoon character in front of the package. So we really need that package of policies to support people reducing UPS.
And Chile's already done that. They have that label. So it's there.
It is. In other countries in Latin America have implemented as well. Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, in Mexico. So there are options out there. And other policy options in those countries that are really exemplary, for instance, in the school feeding meals programs in Brazil, where 90% of the budget has to be for unprocessed and minimally processed foods. So really banning ultra-processed foods from those meals that are offered to over 40 million kids in Brazil.
And it just cuts through. You know, if you knew that as a consumer, if you just look for that label, you would know. And then you can make the decision to eat it or not.
Absolutely.
We're saying don't eat it, but at least you have that information. People can read about this if they have access to The Lancet. I've freaked a few people out that they can't eat their hot chips. So just one more hot chips question that may or may not be from my friend. I'm not sure. What about hot chips in the air fryer? Does that make them okay?
The processing you make at home is not considering ultra processing. So any cooking, air frying, all right. Not all of that. Yeah, definitely use real potatoes.
Stay away from the chips, okay?
Or use real potatoes.
Priscilla, always lovely to see you. Thank you. That research we were talking about has been published today in The Lancet. Let's look forward to hopefully seeing that little label on some of that ultra processed food so we can all make those decisions wisely ourselves. Dr. Priscilla Machado, Research Fellow at the Institute for Physical Activity and Nutrition at Deakin University.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
I think we might have to get Priscilla back in another time because lots of questions, everything from yogurts to baby food to whether there's healthier ways we can eat our hot chips as well. So we might get Priscilla back another time. But you may have heard either in our news, you may have read it over the last 24 hours, that there are huge job cuts happening at the CSIRO. So you have to start to think about where our future scientists, you know, where our innovation will come from. So this is the National Secretary for the Community Public Sector Union. This is Melissa Donnelly. She spoke with ABC News's Joe O'Brien after the announcement of all of these job cuts.
This is not just a restructure or reprioritisation. These are very significant cuts, and it's going to have impact on our capacity, which has implications for farmers, our future scientific capacity, for innovation in a whole range of areas. We've already seen cuts in biosecurity, in health, in food, in agriculture, in digital research, and now we're going to see more, and that is going to have implications. We can talk about productivity, we can talk about driving innovation as a nation, but the CSIRO has to be part of that equation. It is a world-leading scientific institution, and the Albanese government should be backing it.
So where this was posted on the ABC News' Instagram page, one of the hundreds of comments was this, and I want to read it to you. At a time when humanity needs more science and more technology and more innovation to survive, the literal extinction, things like climate change, soil death, water challenges, and the rise of AI, everyone around the world is gutting funding for scientists and eliminating their roles. It makes no sense. We need more scientists, not less. Susan Tonks is from the CSIRO Staff Association. She's the section secretary there. Susan, I couldn't have summed it up more. Surely this is a time when we need to be promoting more scientists, more innovation, more research into areas of everything from biosecurity, agriculture, to cancer research. How do you feel about these job cuts?
Well, you know, it's a very sad day for public science that these further cuts have been announced. And yes, of course, you know, we agree, you know, the depth and the scale of these cuts over the last 18 months is, you know, is shocking. The future of Australian science is on the line here. This is worse than, you know, the worst cuts we've seen to public science than was under the Abbott government.
When will we start to see the implications of something like this? Because research takes a long time. We know that it can be entire lifetimes for people.
Exactly, yeah.
So when and how will we know the impacts of cuts like this?
The impacts of these cuts, you know, we don't need a crystal ball to know that these cuts are going to hurt. They're going to hurt families, farmers, and they're going to hurt our future. We know the important work that CSIRO does. We know that these scientists are doing everything from protecting crops from disease to building resilience in the face of, you know, climate change, strengthening our defence with, you know, against biosecurity risks, driving innovation in health and technology. So how we can, you know, look to 1,100 plus jobs in the last 18 months going from our national science agency and just say it's a, you know, reorganisation to... is, you know, this isn't just reorganisation or restructure. You know, these are deep cuts and it's going to affect our future.
As we just heard in that grab that I played, there is calls for the federal government to step up here.
Absolutely, yep.
Is that likely to happen?
Well, that's a question for the government to answer or the minister. I mean, we think that the Albanese government does need to fix this mess and needs to commit to urgent funding to secure the future of CSIRO.
Susan Tonks, as the Staff Association Section Secretary of the CSIRO, in the 20 years that I've been broadcasting here, I reckon at least once a fortnight I would get pitched a story on STEM and how to get more people involved and excited about STEM, in particular young women. What does something like this do for the next generation of scientists?
Well, it's a really high concern, isn't it, that we want to encourage our young people into STEM careers, and yet, you know, they're looking, and I'm sure many of them look to work at the CSIRO, but then to see, you know, how this is rolling out, I mean, you know, they'd be questioning whether, you know, this is a longer term career. I mean, and that's what it should be. You know, for all our young people that are going into research jobs.
Here's just one text. It says, it's utterly bananas. I'd actually protest over something like this. Yeah. And others that says, the CSIRO cutting staff and research due to lack of government funding just when we need them more than ever. Shame on the federal government, says another. Is there any chance of this not happening, do you think, Susan?
Well, the process is in play, as you obviously you're aware from the announcement. But, yeah, you're right, Rochelle. Unless the government puts its money where its mouth is to secure the funding, it's going to have a very deep impact on our National Science Agency and going forward.
It's interesting, isn't it? People think science doesn't connect them, that isn't relevant to them. Maybe until something goes pear-shaped, until something goes wrong, until somebody you love or yourself gets sick and you need groundbreaking research, until something happens with the climate, with biosecurity, with a infestation of, I don't know, fire ants or some kind of crazy mosquito that's going to take out, you know, entire populations of other plant or flora or fauna. The CSIRO and the different scientists that are there, it covers so many different aspects of our life. I just wonder when, you know, when it will start to hit home, the impacts that it may have on people.
Oh, look, I totally agree. Like, I mean, science impacts everything that we do. It really does require greater investment, not less. We've got scientists who, hundreds of scientists at CSIRO who've dedicated their lives to public science and are pretty much being shown the door. It is longer term, you know, projects that they commence and work on.
So what happens to those projects then, Susan? Do they take it with them or do they just sit there? Do they become dormant?
Well, I would think that it's, you know, it's inevitable that some just will end. I couldn't tell you which ones, but if that's the process.
How's morale? How is everyone?
Oh, it's incredibly low. The mood is incredibly low. And, you know, people are really concerned, especially now. Like, this is a really difficult time for CSIRO staff just ahead of Christmas. You know, they've had apparently 18 months to get to this position in some way, but then all of a sudden this just gets dropped right before Christmas, you know, and it's just a barrage, and we're getting a lot of feedback from members. There's a lot of distressed staff out there that we will, of course, obviously give our support to.
Thanks for your time, Susan. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Susan Tonks, the Staff Association Section Secretary for the CSIRO. Just one of the many texts on this, and either from the science community or budding scientists, Rochelle, the government has been pushing students into STEM career pathways for years. So how does this then make sense to cut funding to the CSIRO? Students have been steered down STEM career paths, will have very limited options once they complete their schooling. That's from Ella, who's in Anglesey. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.